Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymere Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymere.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymere Church of Christ.
Well, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I trust you had a good evening. And wasn't that a wonderful breakfast?
Amen.
Tell you, we buy Wright's bacon over at our place in Arkansas, but we don't cook it that way. and it was really good. So I found out how they cook that stuff, and I'm taking that message back to my wife. It was really delightful. I appreciate the honor of being here, and I appreciate all of you being here and your interest in learning better the Word of God and being able to take that into your ministry. Any piece of literature must be read with an awareness of context. I should say better, contexts, plural. When a person is discussing Scripture with someone and there is a disagreement, one is likely to tell the other, well, you're taking that out of context. What they usually mean by that is out of its literary context. You know, you're making this mean something that did not take place or was not intended in its literary context. And that's very important. This little rule that I learned years ago, words have no meanings in and of themselves. They have meanings only in sentences. And sentences don't have much meaning until they're included in a paragraph. And those paragraphs don't have much meaning until they're included in the larger document. You see how that goes? None of those entities stands alone. It's in a literary context. So when you're studying a passage in Matthew, a particular word in Matthew, you can't really just run to a dictionary and say, oh, this is what this word means. You have to say, what does it mean in this context? As Matthew uses it in his literary context. But that's not what we're talking about this hour. We're talking about cultural context, or sometimes referred to as historical context. But that question has to be raised in terms of historical or cultural contexts, plural. And I'll try to explain that as we go along the way. When we read the Gospels, we have to think in terms of two historical contexts. The context of the story that's being narrated and the context of the writer who is telling us the story. Because those two contexts are different. The context of the ministry of Jesus was back in the late 20s, early 30s, first century. Matthew, who is writing, is writing in the last third, maybe the last half, or at least the last third of the first century. So the contexts are different, and I'll try to explain the significance of that. If a work is relating events that occur in a particular time and place, that time and place needs to be understood in order to make sense of the document. People do not live. Institutions do not exist. Events do not transpire. Words do not have meaning, suspended from time and place. They live, exist, transpire, and have meaning in the time and place they're situated. A time and place that has been conditioned by past history and heritage. So we have to enter that world of their heritage and experience in order to understand best what is being written. But second, at another level, we must be aware of the historical and cultural context in which the author is writing. Knowledge of the context of the writer may help us understand some important features of the document. Let's say, for example, a person is writing a document entitled Contributions of the Marshall Space Flight Center to American Space Exploration. The contents of that document may vary depending on the context in which it is produced, in which it's written. An essay written by a rocket engineer in celebration of the retirement of the Redstone rocket may be quite different from an essay written by an accountant preparing a report for an appropriations committee. The former would naturally focus on mechanical aspects of the Redstone project, while the latter will call attention to financial matters. While both are dealing with the same general subject, the circumstances of the writers dictate, to some degree, the contents. Well, how does this relate to Matthew? Well, when we read Matthew at the first level of cultural context, we're immediately drawn into a world that is not ours. Matthew tells a story that unfolds in Palestine of the early first century. It's a story in which Jewish people participate in and relate to the religious and social institutions of their heritage, a heritage that reaches back for generations, as many references and allusions to the Old Testament in Matthew reveal. It's a world of Sanhedrin, Sadducees, synagogues, and scribes, a world of jots and tittles, of Reka, or Raka, and Corban. Their oaths made by the temple, and other oaths made by the gold of the temple. We find ourselves among Pharisees, parables, and prophecies being fulfilled, most of which are very foreign to our experience in 21st century America. In order to make sense out of Matthew's account, we must understand all of these and countless other matters that relate to the time of the story that Matthew is telling. Here's where there are ample resources that can help us learn the world that gives meaning to the New Testament story. Some are listed in the bibliography that you have there. One that has been very helpful to me is Everett Ferguson's Backgrounds of Early Christianity. It has value because it's written by Dr. Ferguson, who is our Christian brother, who has shared our heritage and still is very committed to providing resources that that help us to understand. While I'm mentioning Everett, I might also mention his outstanding book on the Church of Christ and Ecclesiology for Today, both of these published by Erdmans. I first read Dr. Ferguson's Backgrounds of Early Christianity when it was just in a Xerox copy before it had been published. I was a doctoral student at Emory. And that helped me immensely in understanding the world of the New Testament that we were studying. Of course, I was glad that it later was published. And InterVarsity Press, the Dictionary of Jesus and the Gospels, is a very valuable resource that can help you there. And there are many good commentaries on Matthew that will illuminate with information about the cultural context of the story. I'm reminded of two, one of which I'm not sure is still in print. Some of you may know this better than I. Jack Lewis wrote a very good commentary. It's a two-volume commentary in the Living Word New Testament Commentary, originally published by Sweet, later by ACU Press. ACU Press continued to keep some of those in publication for a while. I don't know if there are any of them that are still in print or not. But Dr. Lewis's commentary on Matthew is strong on helping see the possible relationship of Matthew's account of Jesus to the Jewish literature, the rabbinic literature, of course, that was written down later, but may have significant connections with the earlier time of the New Testament. And then, as the title of this series suggests, the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary. The section on Matthew there, written by Michael Wilkins. As the title suggests, one of the strengths of that commentary, which is not an in-depth commentary, but it does call attention to a lot of the issues of the historical and cultural background out of which the accounts are coming. But anyway, We have to enter that world. It's not our world. And we have to learn it. The second level of cultural setting, the context of the writer, is not a simple matter. In fact, some people question whether or not we can ever know exactly the historical and cultural context in which Matthew wrote. Now, there's sort of a consensus among New Testament scholars that Matthew probably wrote in Syrian Antioch, somewhere in the last third of the first Christian century. But all of that is based on inferences here and there, and the prominent use of Matthew by Ignatius of Antioch in early Christian literature a little bit later. But we really can't be certain. There is no explicit evidence in the biblical text of Matthew that tells us where and when the author wrote. So we're left to try to draw some inferences and maybe make some hypotheses about that. And so it may be the best we can do is what is expressed by Donald A. Carson in his Expositor's Bible Commentary on Matthew. He says, Matthew's reasons for including or excluding this or that tradition, or for shaping his sources, must owe something to the circumstances he found himself in, and the circumstances of his own theology. But it is notoriously difficult to reconstruct such circumstances and commitments from a gospel about Jesus of Nazareth. Carson goes on to point out that the themes that are reflected in Matthew's gospel reflect interests of any decade from the 30s to the end of the first century. So if we're just looking for what themes recur and so forth, it's very difficult to say, well, this would have occurred in this particular location at this particular time, and they're the kinds that can be sort of more generally applicable. So perhaps Richard Baucom, in his Gospel for All Christians, published in 1998, is correct. Rather than thinking of the Gospels as being produced in a particular community at a particular time, we need to think of the Gospels as being produced for the church at large. Certainly, there are special emphases and points that individual writers wish to stress, but those points are pertinent beyond their particular context. Whatever context Matthew was in, his community was not the only one facing the kind of issues that were before him. Luke Timothy Johnson is a Roman Catholic New Testament scholar at Emory University. In his book, The Writings of the New Testament, the chapter on canon, he refers to this idea of New Testament documents being written for communities beyond the original audience. And he says, the particular bears the possibility of becoming general. Now we can see this most clearly in the letters. Paul, for example, writes to the church in Colossae. But at the end of the letter, he says, now when you've read this letter, you send it over to the church at Laodicea. And you see that you read the letter from Laodicea. What's going on there? There's the circulation of the letter from one community to another. Paul, for example, when he would write 1 Corinthians to the church of God in Corinth, he reminds them along the way that what I'm writing, I write in all the, I teach in all the churches. Not just limited to Corinth, but there are other places. And it's that principle that Dr. Johnson expresses here when he says the particular, that is, the document that was written in a particular set of circumstances, bears the possibility of becoming general. That is, it's applicable outside that original setting. And certainly, That was the case with Matthew. It must have been circulated widely and relatively quickly, for it routinely appears first in the canonical lists of New Testament books in the early Christian literature, and historically it has been the most widely used of the Gospels in the history of the church. Ernst Riemann, a noted critical scholar of generations past, said that Matthew was the greatest book ever written. Well, history, you see, sort of gives some fuel to that fire, how often Matthew has been used in the history of the church. Now, in this lesson, in which we talk about the cultural and historical contexts of Matthew's gospel, we can't demonstrate on every hand how an awareness of the historical and cultural context of the story that Matthew tells can help us understand the gospel better. And nor are we able to identify every possible theme or literary strategy that appear in Matthew that may suggest a context in which he was writing. We have to be selective. And so what I will do is call attention to some passages where we can look at both aspects of this question. We can look at some things relative to the historical or cultural circumstances of Jesus' time, and we can at least press the question, what may have been the context in which Matthew wrote that may help us understand why he told the story the way he did? Now, you're familiar enough to know that Matthew, Mark, and Luke are very similar in telling the story of Jesus. That's why they have come to be referred to as the Synoptic Gospels. They view the life of Jesus in much the same way. But you also know there are significant differences among those documents. And I'm not here to try to explain how that came to be, but I am here to say that Matthew does have his special emphases. And those probably reflect the circumstances out of which he was writing. He's telling the story of Jesus, but he wants people of his day, and as we'll see, the church of generations yet to come, to understand the relevance of the message of Jesus. And so that may dictate how he tells the story. Not the story he tells, but how he tells it. So first, let's look at Matthew chapter 2. Herod's massacre of the boys at Bethlehem. After the wise men returned to their home in the east, I begin at verse 13. When they had gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. "Get up," he said, "take the child and his mother and escape to Egypt. Stay there until I tell you. For Herod is going to search for the child to kill him." So he got up, took the child and his mother during the night, and left for Egypt, where he stayed until the death of Herod. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." When Herod realized that he had been outwitted by the Magi, he was furious, and he gave orders to kill all the boys in Bethlehem and its vicinity, who were 2 years old and under, in accordance with the time he had learned from the Magi. Then what was fulfilled through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. What was spoken through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. "A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted, because they are no more." After Herod died, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who were trying to take the child's life are dead." So he got up, took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning in Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, having been warned in a dream He withdrew to the district of Galilee, and he went and fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He will be called a Nazarene. Herod's reaction seems quite extreme in this case. One could contend that Matthew has concocted a dramatic story to embellish this account. Does he manufacture this to make Jesus appear to be like Moses, whose life had been threatened by an evil king? Add to this the fact that there is no extra-biblical evidence of such a massacre of boys in Bethlehem during the time of Herod the Great. So one might have case. However, if we inform ourselves with the information that we do have about Herod the Great, something like this is not hard to understand. That Herod the Great would be upset that someone had been born king of the Jews, and that he would try to eliminate such a person, is surely within character. Herod was not a Jew, he was an Idumean who had been appointed by the Roman Senate as king of Judea. He was ruthless and abusive. He was jealous of anyone who he thought would jeopardize his power. We know from extra-biblical sources that he had several of his relatives, including a wife and three of his sons, killed because he perceived them as threats. The ancient writer Macrobius reports that Caesar Augustus punned that he would rather be Herod's pig than his son. The two Greek words sound alike. And so it'd be better to be Herod's pig than his son. You know, he'd keep the pig alive, he'd kill the son. Flavius Josephus writes of Herod, "He was a man who was cruel to all alike, and one who easily gave in to anger and was contemptuous of justice." It's difficult to think that the killing of a few children in a small village in Judea would have been out of character for a man like Herod. A man who ordered that at his death, many influential Jews should be executed. Because he knew the Jews, who didn't like him very much, would not be mourning for his death, but he wanted there to be mourning at his death. Fortunately, that edict was rescinded after he died, and it was not carried out. But do you see the character of Herod? And understanding that helps us to understand that Matthew's description here of the killing of a few baby boys in a village near Jerusalem was really no big thing for Herod. And it's not like what would hit the newspaper. You know, it's not like Bethlehem was Nashville. It was just a little village. There probably weren't that many boys of that age out there, you see. And then there's this business of Archelaus. When the family came back from Egypt, apparently the impression is left that maybe Joseph had some desire to stay down in Judea. But when he learned that Archelaus was ruling in the place of his father, he went on by and went to Galilee. Herod had three sons who inherited his rule after he died. Of the three, Archelaus was the one who had inherited his father's cruelty. He was notorious for resorting to cruel measures to control the people, including, on one occasion, killing 3,000 Jewish pilgrims who were stirring up a little trouble at a Passover season. Augustus Caesar banished Archelaus to Gaul and appointed Roman prefects to governor Judea, the most famous of which is Pontius Pilate. At least as for our understanding. But again, you see, when we're informed about the historical context, it illuminates the story and helps us see a little bit better what maybe was going on. But what about Matthew's context as he tells the story? Something interesting here. Matthew is writing this as a Christian who recognizes that this story about Jesus has roots in the Old Testament. Three times in this account, he introduces quotations from the Old Testament. He introduces quotations with this formula. Something happened that fulfilled what was spoken by the prophets concerning the flight to Egypt and the return. He quotes from Hosea 11. And so was fulfilled what the Lord had said through the prophet, out of Egypt I called my son. And when he writes about Herod's order to kill the boys in Bethlehem, Matthew writes, then what was said through the prophet Jeremiah was fulfilled. A voice is heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning, Rachel weeping for her children and refusing to be comforted. And then after reporting that Joseph, Mary, and Jesus lived in Nazareth in Galilee, Matthew writes, so was fulfilled what was said through the prophets. He will be called a Nazarene. Now, it's not my purpose here to talk about how Matthew uses these Old Testament texts. He does it frequently. A dozen or so times, Matthew is going to say, such and such happened to fulfill what was said by the prophets. It would be an interesting study for you to study those passages and see the many different ways that Matthew, as a Christian, reads those Old Testament texts and sees the connection between the Old Testament narrative and the narrative of God's greater Son. Yes, God called a son out of Egypt in the Exodus. But Matthew recognizes that God has a greater son, Jesus, whom he called out of Egypt. And he makes the connection. It's a fascinating study. But the point I want to make here is that Matthew is wanting to make a statement in the context in which he's writing, when it's important for people to understand that this story has roots in the Old Testament. And he calls attention to that with these and the many other explicit passages of fulfillment from the prophets. The repetition of ideas or themes provides some insight into the purpose of a writer. As I tell my students, if their parents receive a letter or an email from them in which there are 12 allusions to how much it's costing to be in college, it doesn't take their parents long to figure out what's important to them. Send more money. And so reading through Matthew, and you see a dozen or more explicit appeals to the Old Testament, that the story of Jesus is fulfilling the words of the prophets, it's hard to miss his point. In Matthew 5:17, Jesus says, "Don't think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them." You see how Matthew's frequent appeals flesh that out. This is Jesus' affirmation. Matthew understands that the fulfillment of the Old Testament prophecies comes from Jesus himself. Jesus affirmed it. And as Matthew tells the story, he's calling attention to the many ways that that was seen. In the words of Michael Wilkins, whose commentary I referred to a minute ago, Matthew demonstrates repeatedly that Old Testament hopes, prophecies, and promises have now been fulfilled in the person and ministry of Jesus. Let's look at the second passage. The context of the record of the beginning of Jesus' ministry. Matthew chapter 4, verses 12 through 17. When Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he returned to Galilee. Leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum, which was by the lake in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali, to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah. land of Zebulun and land of Naphtali, the way to the sea along the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. From that time on, Jesus began to preach, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near." Now, when we read this text, we're immediately introduced to some matters that are informed by an awareness of historical and cultural context. That is, of the story that is being told. The reader of Matthew has already been introduced to Nazareth in Galilee, where Jesus' family lived. And now we're introduced to Capernaum. And, you know, when we're studying this, we obviously look to a map to see where those were geographically, how they're located. That's a part of understanding the context. But there's really more here than locating these places on a map. Still maintaining his ties with the Old Testament, Matthew notes that these places are located in the ancient regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, the areas where these two tribes of Israel had settled in the Promised Land, up in the northern part of the region. This provides Matthew another opportunity to tie the story to Old Testament prophecy. This was to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah, he says. Now, from the time these regions in the northern kingdom of Israel were conquered by the Assyrians back in the 8th century, these regions had experienced a steady infiltration of Gentiles. Scholars have often noticed Matthew's Jewish focus. For example, Matthew is the only one of the gospel writers to stress Jesus' limited commission to only the lost sheep of the house of Israel. He affirms it twice, once in Matthew 10, then again in Matthew 15, where Jesus says, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." You see the Jewish focus. However, Matthew's universal perspective has often been overlooked. Matthew includes four Gentile women in the genealogy, a genealogy that sounds very Jewish. Jesus descends from Abraham through David. Right in the middle are Tamar, Rahab, Ruth, and Uriah's wife. These women of Gentile background. The first people to worship the King of the Jews in Matthew's gospel are the Gentile wise men. And despite the sharp Jewish focus of the limited commission in chapter 10, in verse 18, Jesus still tells his disciples that they would be brought before governors and kings as witnesses to them and to the Gentiles. You may remember Jesus' response to the Canaanite woman, to whom he said, "You have great faith." And then to the centurion who was asking help for his paralyzed servant, Jesus says, "I tell you the truth, I've not found anyone in Israel with such faith." And he goes on to say that many will come from east and west, take their places at the feast with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob in the kingdom of heaven, but the subject of the kingdom will be thrown outside into the darkness. There'll be others at the table in the kingdom who are not from the Jewish stock. Those are the Gentiles. And then who is not familiar with the last words of the Gospel of Matthew? "Go ye therefore and make disciples of all the nations." Apparently, Matthew was living at a time when the message of the crucified and risen Messiah had provoked some division in Judaism. There's quite a conflict in Matthew's gospel between the Pharisees and the scribes and Jesus and his disciples. A conflict that is more pronounced in Matthew than any of the other gospels. Why would Matthew want to bring that to the attention of his readers? Maybe because the conflict that he and his fellow Christians were experiencing with the Jewish community from which they had either made a break or were making a break, they needed to understand that those tensions run deep. Even in the days of Jesus, there was tension. And Matthew's living at a time when the message has gone out to the Gentiles. The words of Jesus' commission had been taken seriously by the disciples. And the gospel has been preached to the Gentiles. And the church now has people of both a Jewish and a Gentile background. And Matthew is trying to help Christians of his day have a good understanding of their identity as the people of God. Finally, let's look at the context of Jesus' conversation with the disciples at Caesarea Philippi. Matthew 16. Familiar passage to us, verses 13 through 20. When Jesus came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, still others, Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter answered, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." Jesus replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I'll give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. Whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." Then he warned his disciples not to tell anyone that he was the Christ. Well, again, Caesarea Philippi, located in the north from Galilee, a city built by Philip, one of the sons of Herod, and named for himself, along with Tiberius Caesar. Not sure what Jesus was doing up in that region. Nothing is said. Matthew doesn't say anything about his ministry up there. But he does say he was with his disciples. Maybe this was a retreat. Maybe they were going off to spend time together, as Jesus often did by himself. But nevertheless, Matthew concentrates on the discussion with the disciples. And there are a number of matters that we need to understand in the cultural context of Jesus' day. For example, what's this Son of Man business? Who do you say the Son of Man is? This was apparently Jesus' favorite way of designating himself, most frequently used on Jesus' own lips. What is its significance? Does it simply mean that Jesus himself was a man, which idiomatically the expression Son of Man means? Son of Man simply means man. And is this the way to emphasize what John stressed in John 1? The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. You know, are we calling attention to the fact that we have a high priest who has been tempted in every respect like we are? You know, this is a very important theme of New Testament Christology. Is that the significance of Son of Man? Is that why Jesus adopted this term? Or is the meaning of the term fueled by Daniel 7? Where in that vision, Daniel sees one like a Son of Man coming to the Ancient of Days, to whom the Ancient of Days gives dominion that will never pass away. In other words, is this a messianic title? Dr. Gallagher's would be addressing Jesus as Messiah in Matthew, and he may well draw attention to this, I'm not sure, but it would be a part of that discussion if Son of Man were understood messianically. But here are some options, you see, and when we study this, we'd want to inform ourselves with that discussion. Well, another part of the culture in which Jesus lived was the language. Matthew is written in Greek, Now, there's a statement in an ancient writer that says Matthew wrote a word or a logia, a logian, in Hebrew. And there was often some discussion that Matthew may have originally written his document in Aramaic or Hebrew. We have no manuscript evidence of any document like that. And people who have studied the language of Matthew's gospel seem to suggest that it was a Greek document. It doesn't reflect that it was a translation document. And it may well be, you see, that Jesus spoke in Aramaic, as many people did in Palestine, Jewish people in Palestine of that day. But Greek had been around for years, since the days of Alexander the Great, as Hellenism had come into that region. But the point I'm wanting to make is that in this discussion, Jesus apparently makes some play on words. You're Peter, rock. And upon this rock, I will build my church. You've been a part of that discussion, haven't you? Really, what's going on here? Is Jesus saying, Peter, you're a rock, and I'm going to build my church on you? Well, we've shied away from that because of Roman Catholic theology that Peter was the first pope. But I have to acknowledge that Paul says that that Christ built the church on the foundation of the holy apostles and prophets in Ephesians chapter 3, isn't it? So, I personally don't have a problem with thinking that Peter and the other apostles, in some sense, are the foundation of the church. Paul said they were. But I also know in other passages, Paul can say no other foundation is laid than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. But that's the discussion we have, you know, when we think about this theologically. But understanding something about the words there may help us as we interpret it. But that's not what I'll emphasize. And I'm running out of time, and this was my best point, so I'm going to go real fast here. Andrew, have I got time to do this in about a few minutes? Jesus says, upon this rock I will build my church. I'll build my church. Bible scholars have often called attention to Luke as the gospel writer who realized that the ministry of Jesus continued in the history of the church. After all, he's the only one that wrote the rest of the story, isn't that right? Luke is the only one who has a sequel to the story of Jesus. So Luke understood that the ministry of Jesus had a life beyond itself. I believe Matthew understood that as well. Matthew didn't write a sequel, but he's the only gospel writer to use the word church. Matthew 16:18, Matthew 18:17. And the Great Commission of Matthew 28 implies that there is life ahead for those who would become his disciples. Remember? Go make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them into the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe everything that I have commanded you. And I am with you, even to the end of the age. There's life beyond among those who would become disciples of Jesus. One of the most significant stylistic features of Matthew is his alternation between narrative and teaching sections. These are clearly demarcated by a repeated formula that comes at the end of the teaching sections. For example, at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, close of Matthew 7, and after Jesus finished saying these things, and then in chapter 11, after the mission charge to the disciples, when Jesus had finished instructing his disciples. You'll read this along the way. That calls attention to five major sections in Matthew that are fundamentally teaching material. Matthew is writing the teachings of Jesus. This is the most comprehensive account of the teachings of Jesus. Why is he doing that? Well, listen again to the Great Commission. What are those who become disciples of Jesus to be taught to do? Obey everything Jesus has commanded. Where do you learn that? Suppose you had only read Matthew's gospel. Where would you learn that? Back in the gospel that calls attention to Jesus, who is the Lord of the church, who speaks, and the church listens. Any of you remember the old E.F. Hutton commercials? When E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. In Matthew 11, verses 25 and following, Jesus says, "I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and learned and revealed them to your little children. Yes, Father, for this was your good pleasure. All things have been committed to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and those to whom the Son chooses to reveal him." See what the Jesus of Matthew's gospel is here? He's the link between the Word of the Father and those to whom Jesus has revealed the Father. Twice in Matthew, we hear God from heaven say concerning Jesus, "This is my beloved Son." Again, you hear the Father, Son imagery. In the second of those passages, in Matthew 17, God says, "This is my beloved Son in whom I am pleased. Listen to him." Listen to him. Matthew is writing the story of Jesus to help disciples of his generation to understand their identity as the people of God, who are committed to Jesus Messiah, who is the Lord of the church, whose voice must be heard and must be obeyed. The early chapters of Acts say the early Christians continued in the apostles' teaching. A part of that, according to chapter 3, is that Jesus is the prophet like Moses. And anybody who does not listen to him will be cut off from among the people. Some people said that churches of Christ are experiencing an identity crisis these days. We may be. Matthew's church was likely suffering an identity crisis. Who are we? And Matthew says, we are the people of God who listen to Jesus. And we're bound by His Word. He is the Lord of the church. Didn't leave any time for questions, but there's a panel later, right?
Yes.
And so if you have questions based on what I had to say, then please feel free to ask them at that time.
Yeah, be sure to jot those down as we go through the morning.